ridiculous.
Welcome, friends, to Perfect Stranger Things, a weekly dance of joy for your eardrums. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, Steve and I cover The Dive. This was my favorite episode of the season so far. I know I gave episode 4 high praise. This one even exceeded that. So far, this is shaping up to be a very strong season. Steve and I are both really enjoying it. Before we get to that coverage, a few genius gems from that golden gaucho. That's right, it's Mr. Wilford Brimley.
You got a story in here. This is the damnest story you ever read. Tell you what we're going to do. We're going to sit right here and talk about it. Now, we'll talk all day if you want it.
It's the right thing to do.
Steve, we're covering The Dive. This is episode 6 of season 4. 1 hour, 15 minutes. What do you think about that?
I'm in for it. I'm in for longer episodes. I've always, you know, after doing the rewatch of all the Stranger Things, I was kind of taken aback at how, you know, they're just not very long seasons, right? And so I'm here for more of it.
All right, so I took the opposite view. I was always thinking, man, I appreciate how tightly these stories are created. I just feel like there's not an empty minute in this entire series. It's so well crafted.
Right.
And then I saw the runtime of these last couple episodes, and I was thinking, uh-oh, is this a Game of Thrones pacing issue that we're going into here? But I will say this. This is my favorite episode of the season.
Is that right?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Big time.
Wow, I can't wait to get into it.
Oh, man. Fans, so good. So good. There was about an empty 2 minutes of this, but otherwise, everything else was dynamite. I love this
episode.
That's wonderful. Okay, note to Brian and Derek, who both emailed me to tell me that they hate Goochers. You will be happy to know that this week there are no Goochers in play because I've identified 8 storylines, and so I have a nice, even-sided die that I'm going to roll. And that is what I'm going to do right now. So we have ourselves a 5, and 5 is Mike, Will, Jonathan, and Argyle. The boys arrive in Utah and enter Susie's Lord of the Flies house. The boys ask Susie for computer help as Argyle falls in love with Ally Sheedy. It turns out that Susie's father has confiscated the computer. They devise a plan to get access to the computer. Susie explains computer tech and prints out a geolocation in Nevada. I don't know where they found this Ally Sheedy doppelganger. She's perfect.
Yeah.
I mean, if you told me this was CGI, I would totally believe it. This whole scene was worth it just to see that reveal. That was such a nice little Easter egg for me.
Yeah, and it really ties. So we've been talking about, like, there's these Breakfast Club-ish moments, yeah. Right? Or at least character-wise, like we've yeah. seen. Eddie could sort of be the Bender.
Yeah, character. And Jason could be the Emilio Estevez.
Freddie could be your Anthony Michael Hall.
Oh, I think you're right. Freddie's the guy who was sort of the journalism nerd.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah, totally. You're right. That makes sense. So who's Molly Ringwald in this scenario?
So, I don't know that it's Angela, but...
Oh, interesting.
Because I don't know, the Valley Girl doesn't quite
mesh. But she would have the same social currency.
Right. That's kind of what I was thinking. So it feels like that we might have it all sort of out. And then, of course, the Ally Sheedy just shows up as just straight up.
She's the nanny in a large Mormon family
mm-hmm.
who is not impressed by the family of geniuses. This was fantastic. I loved it so much. Last we spoke, you were not. You felt like you could do it with a little bit less of the Susie's house.
Yeah, I mean, it was, you need, the location of the Nina Project. So so that's where Susie's house comes together. It just felt like a real big, I don't know. It's a lot of this is played obviously for laughs and goofs. It's purely comic relief, which is fine. But I mean, it doesn't really move the story any further outside of her being able to give them the location.
Okay, now I'm going to reveal just how nerdy I am, Steve. For me, this was a Tom Bombadil moment. There's a debate in the Lord of the Rings fandom about whether Tom Bombadil is a necessary component of the novel because it's this moment where there's a lot of menace around. There's a lot of, you know, the hobbits are facing danger at every turn. And then you have this little vacation with this kind of all-knowing creature who's not affected by evil. That's Tom Bombadil. So I felt like Susie was a little bit Tom Bombadil in that we got a little respite from all of the menace that's happening everywhere else in the story. Russia and California and Hawkins, Indiana, and the Nevada lab. And we got this little moment where we got to experience a tiny little Disney-esque vacation at Susie's house. And I liked it.
Okay. I mean, it was definitely, I mean, every moment's over the top, though, right? I mean.
Well, all right. Let's talk about that. So the music is really played for like a, it's almost like a Home Alone sequence.
Mm-hmm.
Or I think some of the music was a little bit like Robin Williams in Hook or something like that. You almost have that little Lost Boys homage at the very beginning when they open the door and the kid is dressed up like a Lost Boy.
Right.
It was all very farcical, absolutely over the top. It made me recall, after season one, I think one of the Duffer brothers was being interviewed and he said that in season one of Stranger Things, the teenagers are in Nightmare on Elm Street, the kids are in Goonies, and the adults are in Aliens. So those were the three different tones that they were going for. So I did like the idea that if you go to a different geography or a different friend group, you're going to find a different cinematic sensibility there. And for me, this was sort of a Home Alone sensibility.
Maybe it's hidden in the code somehow?
What you just said makes no sense.
Hold your butts, I'll just trace the IP.
The I what?
The Internet Protocol Address. It's a unique numerical label given to all information technology connected to the Internet.
What's the Internet?
Don't worry about it. It's just gonna change the world.
All right, so we've taken a... We've thrown a little the Ally Sheedy component. So maybe I was thrown off a little bit too by that. Like she shows up there.
Right. Sure.
And, which, you know, okay. You know,
it might have been nostalgia for me too, because that was the house I grew up in. We there were six of us. Most of us were either like really outgoing personalities or sort of brooding introverts that resented everyone else.
Right.
I'll let you decide who I am in that, that mix. So it was just chaos. The whole thing was chaos. And it wasn't just us kids. It was like my mom was running a daycare. So there were always like three or four other kids that didn't belong there. At least that's my view of it. and so it was just total chaos all the time. And which is why I now live in Dayton, Ohio. And the rest of my family lives in California.
Well, it also could be something where the Duffer brothers are giving us an origin story for the Ally Sheedy character that's actually in The Breakfast Club. This is who she is and why she chooses to act the way she does.
Right. There was part of me that thought, is this just a device to bring in Ally? Because we don't know what happens to the Ally Sheedy character. We don't know if she gets in the van and goes to Hawkins with the rest of the kids or goes to Nevada with the rest of the kids. I would not be surprised if she just ditches the whole scene and now we bring Ally Sheedy with us on our little romp to Nevada. So I don't know. I mean, maybe this is all a device to bring in one more character into the mix, which I'm okay with. I'm totally okay with it.
Yeah, no, I didn't have it. I mean, it was fun. It was definitely fun. But I mean, if there was going to be a secret, and maybe that's because I'm starting to feel like maybe their journey, the Will, Jonathan, Argyle, Mike journey is at times it feels a little tedious. Because they don't, then it sort of feels like, okay, well now we're filling the runtime, you know, whereas the Hopper, as the Hopper sequences seem to get a little more, succinct, and they seem to be, now moving towards a more clear purpose or end goal. Then the other part of the journey feels like, okay, well, like maybe it is to your point. It's like, okay, well, let's have a little more comic relief. We've got Argyle in there.
We've talked about this a lot.
It's kind of an onslaught of comic relief, though. Yeah. You've got Argyle and a Home Alone house. And it's like, well, you've already got it built in there, you know.
We've talked a lot about this in our Game of Thrones podcast. And you brought this up a lot. Like, every now and again, like, that show is so dark that every now and again you just need that moment of goodness for just a tiny taste of water when you're in the desert, right?
Right, right.
And that's what this scene did for me, although this is clearly not as dark as Game of Thrones, but I think it probably is the darkest season we've seen yet. I'm not just talking about this, like the gore factor or like the death count. I'm just thinking like just the overall tonality.
Yeah, and I mean, you don't, I mean, I think we talked about that with the whole the Dear Billy episode. We didn't know what they were going to do. So it feels like everything's fair game in terms of who could be on the chopping block. And I don't think we've had that experience before.
Well, let's do a quick comparison here on just the bully theme in season one. You know, you got like maybe two scenes of the kids being bullied, but then L kind of comes in, saves the day, makes the kid pee his pants. It's like were the bullies all that menacing? But in this season, you've got the bullies in the lab that bully L. You got the bullies in, you know, at the roller rink, and the whole town is kind of grabbing pitchforks, you know, to go after the Hellfire Club. You could say the whole town is kind of becoming that in Hawkins, and so that's all very dark. So even aside from any kind of magical stuff, any horror stuff,
And that's not going away, right? Even if you dispatch Vecna, and that's kind of been, I think, part of the compelling storyline has been the horror that exists in real life.
Let me ask you about Ally Sheedy for a moment.
Mm-hmm.
When I think of Ally Sheedy, my memory goes directly to Breakfast Club. Mm-hmm. I don't think that she's part of that ensemble, right? But I don't think that she's like the most important character in that movie. But for some reason, I only ever think of Breakfast Club when I think of Ally Sheedy. Do you think of anything else?
With Ally Sheedy?
Yeah.
Well, she wasn't, I'm sure she was in plenty of stuff. I think she was in St. Elmo's Fire, which I had never seen. But I mean, I think Short Circuit.
Yeah. War Games.
Right. War Games. Sure.
I'm looking at her IMDb page. I mean, she's in a ton of stuff. It's just that role just like completely overshadowed anything else she did in my mind. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, it was a pretty iconic movie for characters, creating iconic characters. Right. I mean, and we were of an age when we experienced it where it's like, Hughes did a pretty good job of like capturing all the cliques in one film, right? I mean, that's kind of what it's doing, is it's breaking down those cliques that we're so used to. So all the characters, I think, stand out in a way where it's like, I mean, let's be honest, what's your other Judd Nelson, you know, association?
None. No, there is no other. If you were to tell me that he was never in another movie, I'd believe.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to be stretching to go and be like, oh, of course, New Jack City. You know what I mean? Like, that's where you'd have to.
No, I'd be like, Judge Reinhold? Are we talking about Judge Reinhold?
Yeah, right. I mean, and he was. I mean, I could think of a few things that he was in, or I can at least think of. Try to remember what the covers of the VHS were. And the same thing but if you really look at it, I mean, like Molly Ringwald, obviously her career beyond John Hughes is also a little bit like, huh. And then, you know, Emilio Estevez of those is probably the one that has the bigger, or the best possibility of being able to be associated with something besides Breakfast Club.
Yeah, maybe so. I mean, Molly Ringwald had a number of other sort of teenage roles that kind of blend together, you know?
Pretty in Pink, 16 Candles.
Right. Yeah, it's sort of her trifecta there.
Right. Whereas, you know, in Anthony Michael Hall, I mean, yeah, he also leaning into sort of the Hughes DNA more so, right, with Weird Science and 16 Candles. But, I mean, not like a lot of people are going, oh, yeah, Anthony Michael Hall, Johnny B. Goode. I remember when he plays the quarterback.
I'm going to roll these dice. Roll this thing.
Yeah, usually Anthony Michael Hall will kill a conversation.
With an elephant lamp and a flare gun.
That's right.
Number one is Jason. I'm glad that we get to talk about this. Powell and Callahan question Jason about Patrick's death. Jason is convinced that Eddie is a vessel for demonic powers. The cops, as usual, struggle with the testimony. The other cops search the lake. Later on, Powell attempts to calm down an angry mob. Jason makes a speech at the town hall and blames all of Hawkins' weirdness on the Hellfire Club. Then the townsfolk exit to get their pitchforks. So this was a delightful little twist for me.
Yeah, we talked, we teased a little bit on the last one, but yeah.
Uh-huh.
It revs the show up and complicates it so much further.
Right, because at the end of the last episode, I was thinking, okay, this is now Jason's going to see the error of his ways. You know, there's no way Eddie would have killed those people. Nope, that's not how religion works, Steve. Jason is convinced that Eddie has somehow made a pact with Satan. And so he ultimately is part of this plot. And of course, the Hellfire Gang is absolutely to blame because they become vessels for the satanic, you know. And so to see that element at the beginning of this episode, it was like, oh, of course that's what's going to happen. And I didn't see it coming. So it just wonderful storytelling.
Yeah, and I think it's really something, too, because with the, like you said, it's like, that's not the way religion works. And so he sees something unbelievable, right? Like, so he can't, you know, you wouldn't have a way to process it. And this is what a wonderful juxtaposition about these kids. We talked about this, and I think we did the first season, about how, like, no one's really able to grasp the magic or the supernatural elements like the kids are, because they exist in their own imaginations as much as they exist in the real world. So they're more apt to believe, right? So now we have something fanciful happening and we have a new audience for it. And that audience is one that's like, okay, I don't know that there's supernatural stuff outside of my religious upbringing. So the only thing that could possibly explain this thing is it has to be a work of a supernatural realm that I have some, whether it's limited or not, some knowledge of, and can then, you know, now I know how to assign this. I'm somehow,
most Christians don't believe in magic unless it's Jesus magic,
right,
or devil magic.
Yeah, right? There's two types of magic. It's Jesus magic, devil magic. If I like it, it's Jesus magic. If I don't like it, it's devil magic. I just summed up religion.
Well, here's the other thing I like about this. You know, this show hasn't done a lot with religion, even though it's a small town in Indiana in the 1980s. And so there's absolutely going to be, you know, 90% Christians. There's going to be 20 churches. You know, there's going to be all kinds of religious complications. I mean, you even brought Exorcist themes into season two and didn't really play with the religion of the town at all. In this scene, we absolutely see, look, if we're going to be talking about the satanic panic, you're going to have to at least nod to the Christianized West, right? And so I loved it when Jason quotes Romans 12:21. You know, he says something like,
last night I became overcome with this feeling of hopelessness. Then I remembered Romans 12:21. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And God knows there's good in this town. So much good. It's in this room. It's in this room. Right here. Right now.
overcome evil with good. The way that Jason interprets this is, look, this town's good. Let's go kick the evil's ass.
Right.
You know, something like that, right? But I love that they use that bit of scripture, because if you look at the context of that passage, it's sort of Paul's statement for pacifism.
Yeah.
And it's all about don't avenge yourselves. And I thought it was delicious.
Yeah.
He twists it in order to take this passage that's supposed to bespeak pacifism and use it as a bludgeon. And this is exactly what's going to happen in a town meeting like this.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I love the sequence. Really feels a lot like almost a reverse result, but it's the Kevin Bacon speech in Footloose.
It totally is. I was trying to figure out where that scene, I was like, this scene reminds me of something. Is it? But you're right. It was totally Footloose.
Where he's pulling out scripture to explain why dancing and music should be allowed. Mm. And I mean, it gave me those vibes. And I love me some Footloose.
Perfect.
Love me some Footloose. And so
Oh, that's such a great scene.
Because I think Heather was like a little bit, this scene may have taken her a little bit out, just because she's like, they're not going to just let him talk. And I'm like, first off, you got to let him talk. But I love what they're doing is, like, there's a certain, not ineptitude of the police, but I think they're really trying to demonstrate that post Hopper, they don't have a lot of control. And as long as everything's fine, they're fine policemen.
Okay. Look, I'm going to call this out. All right. 1980s, small town Indiana, there's no way. I mean, let's just call it 80% of this town is not okay with a black chief of police. Mm. All right, that's the first thing. Second thing is, captain of the basketball team is like a god in this town.
Right.
And on top of that, he's a white kid who's talking with religious language.
Yeah, yeah.
This kid is absolutely more interesting to them than anything Powell has to say.
Well, and I just love what they're... I mean, there's so many interesting critiques that are going on. And the idea that the senior basketball player with his... who's got this penchant for speeches and rallying everybody to an end. It's just... it really shows a simplistic nature of thought. The elevation of sport, you know. So there's mm-hmm. so I think that this whole season, or all the shows really, the seasons building up to it, have really kind of been the Duffers, sort of their critique of maybe their high school experience, you know, and who had the voice and who didn't have the voice. And I wonder too, when you talked about like the teasing of religious themes up until this season where it's but more explicit, is that just the nature of having to deal with the Satanic Panic storyline, or is it now that the Duffers have that much more clout, they're like, hey, we can now maybe if you come out really heavy into sort of this, have an obstacle being Western Christianity in the first season, you may not grab as many viewers. And
well, it's a little bit more controversial, and I think that there was something about this show in season one that was a very unifying moment, right? See, everyone loves Stranger Things. It didn't matter what generation you were, didn't matter whether you were tuning in for, you know, the kid adventure or the nostalgia or whatever. Even though it was kind of a horror themed show, it was kind of wholesome.
Right.
There was a little bit of like Back to the Future element.
Right.
To
this thing. The E.T. being such a big part of,
right.
I think the E.T. DNA is throughout the entire series. And it's very Spielbergian in the sense that it's like, it's, I mean, we've talked about Spielberg's, you know, Jaws. We've talked about E.T., we've talked about his hand in Poltergeist, so he's no stranger to thriller and horror and all that, but there's not necessarily wholesome, but definitely a much more accessible way to get there, right? And that's what I think Stranger Things is really tapped into. It feels as much a tribute to Spielberg as anything else. So I think that these elements are all coming together you know, in a big way that really, you know, you find out how, like, their messaging seems to be pretty clear throughout all of the seasons leading up. And this one just has so many elements that I, you know, again, you know, nostalgic in a new way, because not just nostalgic from a film perspective, but from a cultural perspective. That's what I think is really taking a hold on this one, is like that satanic panic period may not have been like a very long period, but it was definitely an important period of my growing up.
And I will take this moment to say that over at Cocoons of Horror, search for Cocoons of Horror wherever you search for podcasts, we cover Jaws, E.T., and Poltergeist.
And stick around for all the other stuff, too.
Stick around for The Golden Child.
Stick around for Teen Wolf.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on the series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on the 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
This is a number 4. Did I do 4? No, I did not. This is what I'm calling the Scooby-Doo gang. The gang rolls up to the crime scene and learns that Patrick has been murdered. Eddie steals a walkie-talkie from a construction site and gets in touch with the gang. They all decide to meet up at Skull Rock. Max and Lucas have a little moment in the woods. Robin hints to Nancy that she might be happier with Steve, and then the girls become friends in an official capacity. They learn from Eddie the exact time of Patrick's murder and surmise Vecna's modus operandi. Dustin uses compass logic to deduce that there is a snack-sized gate in the woods someplace. That night, the four older kids boat out to the middle of Lover's Lake. Steve gets pulled into the Upside Down through a water gate. Then the rest of them go through to help him. Steve is attacked by mini Nazgul birds. Meanwhile, the cops catch up to Max, Dustin, and Lucas.
So this is where we get our my noticing of the second Pulp Fiction, or the second Tarantino reference.
Yeah, I wrote that down too.
Yeah, you caught that one.
No, man, I'm pretty goddamn far from okay.
Exactly, right? Yeah, so it's like, these are the only two that stood out to me. I don't know if they just, they for sure could be a coincidence, but it sure didn't feel like it, especially back-to-back episodes.
So that's, is that a Travolta line or is that an Eric Stoltz line?
That line is a Ving Rhames line.
Oh, that's right. It's after the Gimp scene.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's of course. That's right. Yeah, it's nice to know that. Well, and it makes sense that they'll bring in a little bit of Tarantino, even though we're you know firmly in the 90s at that point. But they've introduced a California, Southern California theme,
right?
So yeah, I'm appreciating the Tarantino.
Yeah, so I mean it did stand out anyway. So Eddie's, so now you're okay with Eddie. You know, you were not a big Eddie guy before. So
you know what? I've warmed to Eddie, and I didn't hate the Hopper plot in this episode.
Yeah, me neither. Because it feels like it's moving somewhere, I think. And I feel like I'm getting Hopper not just as a punching bag, which is nice. I mean, he is, right. But I feel like, I mean, it'd be nice to have a little Hopper with purpose.
Well, I think Eddie is becoming a more sort of three-dimensional character for me.
Mm-hmm.
I liked that. the Lord of the Rings metaphor really separates the nerds from the norms,
right?
In this wood scene,
yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like as soon as Eddie starts talking Lord of the Rings, Dustin kind of starts jumping up and down, knowing exactly what he means,
right?
And the rest of them are like, "What? What the hell's Mordor? What?"
Right. Yeah, for sure. About? Which I think is funny. And I like that too, because it would have been easy to not do that, because Lord of the Rings is now more, people are more aware of it because of the films than anybody would have been during that time frame.
Oh, sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I totally dug that. I thought, you know, of course these kids are divided along the Lord of the Rings fault lines. And I thought that they played that perfectly. I think that one of the things I really liked about this episode was Steve going into the Upside Down gate. So finally, we see one of the main characters in the Upside Down.
Right. So it does feel like it's all coming back together, right? Like we know that
it feels like it's finally coming back together. I loved the boat scene where Harrington takes off his shirt and Max is looking through.
That was hilarious. That's such a great moment. And they take their time on it too, while she just sits there and looks. No, and
Lucas is just like, I'm not really sure what I can do at this moment.
Well, what I like about Max too, is that we get Max. Finally, Max gets a little comic relief and for a bit, you know, she was funny in earlier episodes, but I mean, it was kind of nice to feel like, okay, we just got a sense of, like, talk about that cool drink of water, you know. That's what that felt like for me. It was like, okay, Max is not just, like, it's no longer just there as a tragic, you know, centerpiece. Like,
She gets to have a kid moment.
Yeah, yeah.
She gets to have a kid moment. And then at the same time, you're looking at Lucas's face and he's thinking, there's nothing I can do here.
Yeah.
unless I can speed up time and become 4 years older than I am right now. This is not working for me.
And Harrington still has it, you know, which is great.
It's nice to know he still has it.
Yeah. Yeah. So the dynamic now between the older kids, which is fun, right? Because I think a lot of times the older kids, if I'm looking back, I mean, it's been Nancy, Jonathan. We've had like Steven and Robin. So it's just nice to get a bunch of, like, now we got a collection of older kids. Right. And I think that matters a little bit. Like, I mean, I do like, obviously, the original younger, you know, group that
we... Well, you had to split them up because you needed the Scooby-Doo gang, right?
And so to create a Scooby-Doo
gang.
And
I loved that Eddie was, like, perfectly Shaggy. He was, like, you know, he's a coward. He's a total coward. It's perfect.
Yeah. Yeah, it is great. And it is... It's funny how, like, even if people don't make the initial Scooby-Doo connection, it's when you're putting something together that's, I mean, it's a tried and true collection. And mm-hmm. like, even when you were saying with the Footloose thing, like, you're like, I don't know what this is from, but I know it's from something. So your brain kind of already is sure. embracing the moment. Uh-huh. And I think that's what goes on so well with all of these little moments. And they're not over the top either. It's not like it's so obvious, right? We don't have Robin saying jinkies or anything like that. Right. Which, you know,
what we, if we got it, I would not mind.
Exactly. Right. But providing you these little memories without overdoing it, right? So it doesn't have to be exactly mm-hmm. spot on.
Well, what they'll do is they'll take something that is like an overt thumbprint, like the Ally Sheedy, but they'll put that person in a different scene.
Right.
Like we noticed in previous episodes, there might be some War Games DNA going on here. Mm-hmm. And of course, Ally Sheedy's in War Games, right? So, you know, it's just nice. It's nice to have the Easter eggs, not always that obvious, but every now and again you'll.
And they're not like obvious. It'd be one thing if she was doing everything that Ally Sheedy was doing in Breakfast Club for some reason in that house. But she exists. And there's also the thing you can take away from it too, where you go, my gosh, is that, why is she there? And then on the other hand, you'd be like, well, the movie came out. She might have really liked that look. That was very typical, right? I mean,
It doesn't necessarily have to take you out of the story. And for generations that were not connected to the Breakfast Club, it doesn't have to mean anything.
Exactly.
It could just be, this is the kind of girl that Argyle is going to be into.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And exactly. And so it exists on that level too, right? I mean, that's what's just so great about the balancing act that they have, is that you can sit there and have these memory jogging moments, but you don't dwell enough to be like, ah, and then you go on to the next thing and you're still.
Yeah, it'd be
in.
Really easy to overdo it so that you're not actually in the story anymore.
Right.
I think they're pretty good about that. So, all right, I'm going to roll this thing. Number two is the Sullivan plot. I don't think we should belabor this, but Sullivan and goons torture one of Owen's goons named Wallace. Sullivan worries over Eleven, who he blames for the Hawkins freak show. He's also worried that Brenner's people will sell her to the Soviets. Wallace is forced back into a box. So I thought, you know, I mentioned that there could have been like a little bit of fat that we could trim here. Mm-hmm. This is like one of those scenes that's supposed to have like a high emotional stake.
Right.
But it's populated by characters that no one cares about.
True. I do think that the value that it serves is it ups the ante for what Sullivan is willing to do to get L.
All right, I could see that.
So to show him, because I think up until this point, you know, we know that he's got like the military behind him and everything, but you know, in so many cases, especially if you're thinking along the lines of some of the 80s movies that we've been referencing, you may not see them as this torturous, you know, that's not something we're used to from the 80s perspective. At least the films are concerned. So you could just see him as another, now the military's after you, you know, and instead these stakes are real high for this guy. And I mean, if torture's on the table, that's a pretty big deal.
I guess so.
You don't care.
The guy that's getting beat up, like, I don't want to see him beat up, and yet I don't know him. I learned in this very scene that his name is Wallace.
Right.
That's how little I care about him. Sullivan, I've seen in, what, 3 scenes so far? So I don't really... Yeah, I just... These are characters that mean nothing to me, so...
Yeah, because the other agent that ends up dying in the van, you have maybe more of an emotional connection to. One, because you actually saw him go out of his way to risk his life, you know, all the way through for these kids. And, like, he dies in Argyle's van. So that has, like, sort of an emotional impact just by virtue of the fact that Argyle just thought he was going to go pick up his buddies.
Well, the reason why that has an impact is because it's going to freak out the people that we care about.
Right, exactly.
You know, we care about Jonathan. We care about Mike. We care about, maybe to a lesser extent, Argyle. But we have to see some of our favorite characters go through this traumatic experience. Even though we don't know who the goon is or don't care about the goon, that has emotional weight to it, in a way that this other scene doesn't.
Exactly. So, but again, I think in order to set up, because the Sullivan character, I mean, that's the thing is we're seeing, there's so many complications, right? I mean, there's so many things that and we talked about this, and I think in the last recap was, you know, Vecna's done less damage on a, at least that we can see, than some of these other villains we've encountered, or at least lasting damage, right? I mean, we don't know what the angry mob is capable of, and we don't know what Jason and his cohorts are capable of. We are going to see what happens to bullies, you know, in the past in the Hawkins lab. But there's like Vecna's, I mean, really, I mean, Vecna's the most terrifying, but doesn't, I mean, it's kind of a one by one type situation, right? I mean, it's there may be more mass destruction out there in the way of getting to Vecna.
Well, I think if you're going to say one thing about Sullivan, it's that, you know, does he really care about the so-called serial killer in Hawkins, or does he care about reacquiring the asset before it gets sold off to the Soviets?
Right. So there's an yes.
And I think it's the latter.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. I mean, it's if he's willing to torture to get information, I don't think he's really concerned about a small town in Indiana.
Exactly. All right, I'm going to roll it. Already had a one. All right, we got a three. 11, Brenner and Reiser. Brenner is convinced that Elle will regain her powers as she regains her suppressed memories. 11 feels guilt over her memory of the Hawkins massacre. Brenner tells her that she has demons in her past. Elle tries to make her Plinko puck get to into slot three, but to no avail. Then the creepy blonde guy tells 11 about a mysterious person named One. 11 remembers her mother after being prompted to find her anger. Brenner creates a sumo-style contest to pit the Padawans against each other. One boy seems unbeatable until 11 dominates him. Afterward, 11 discovers that the creepy blonde dude is being tortured by Brenner. A lot of torture this episode. Then she gets bullied by three Padawans in the Rainbow Room. Like I mentioned, like I was a little bit worried about 11 fatigue before.
Mm-hmm.
Not at all this episode.
For
I was
sure.
thrilled. I was thrilled this episode. I loved hearing Brenner's voice in the dojo. You know, so he had that kind of echoey voice where he's calling out numbers of kids to spar. I thought that
right.
was fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
I love what they're doing with the CGI between the young 11 in the reflection and the older 11.
Yeah.
It's really working for
me. Yeah, I think, and it's because there are times where it's like, it's fun when they do it because like you will get caught back up and you're not really, I mean, you know, it's in the, you know, it's taking place in the past, but you also know it's kind of a vision. But then when you see her so little, you're like, oh man, these stakes are way different.
Yeah, absolutely. It brings a sort of a different, and it reminds you that this is a dream state, right?
Right.
This isn't a sort of a pristine memory. There's some kind of weird distortion that's happening.
Right.
Reiser is he a little Jiminy Cricket here for Brenner, or how am I supposed to be reading Reiser?
It kind of feels like he's trying to be. Like, I get the sense that Reiser wants to believe that whatever Brenner's trying to do is good for Elle and good for mankind.
Because he's playing it like he has a, you know, he actually has feelings. Like he doesn't want to see 11 suffer. That's how I'm reading
yeah,
him, right?
That's what I'm getting out of it too. And that like he, like his convincing of Elle to go along with him, like, I believe that he genuinely, at least on some level, believed a lot of what he said when he was trying to convince her. And even though he knew he couldn't tell her everything because she wouldn't come for that, but like I think he believes in the mission statement, or at least he needs to believe that it's going to all work out so that Elle still trust him. I mean, I think, like, again, I think we're starting to see that Reiser was genuine-ish.
Well, you know what I was thinking? I'll run this past you. So Eleven's going to have to get out of there at some point, right? Mm. And she's going to need a way out. After this episode, I was thinking, I wonder if once she regains her powers, whether Paul Reiser will end up betraying Brenner and sort of becoming the Nick Fury character that we had guessed at earlier.
Right. I can see that.
In other words, it's sort of in his character to be, to betray, right? He's Paul Reiser and the show's interested in aliens. So I just feel like maybe everyone's kind of conning everyone else.
Yeah, that could work. I mean, that's, he serves, I mean, kind of a basic function in that. It does help. Because I think we don't know for sure, right? I mean, like, that's where we're at. We're like, what is Brenner doing? Right? Like, what does it do him any good to get Elle's power back? There's got to be more to it than just, oh, she should have her powers back and she could be helpful. So I don't know if the Reiser thing is almost a deal with the devil type situation. Where Reiser knows the other stakes, because Reiser knows that Sullivan's like that sort of prompted.
Yeah, maybe this is sort of a Lando making a deal with Darth Vader kind of thing.
So we're getting the Lando angle with maybe knowledge in advance, because we do, because remember there was the Lando issue. They thought Hopper was Lando in
probably season one. I think.
And that's kind of a similar thing that we've seen, is where Hopper will make it. A decision, you know, make a deal that you know is like, well, this may not be the best deal. He's like he had to make a deal, right? And so that's been a common theme for especially the adults throughout all of the seasons, is trying to choose the lesser of the evils, right? Like making decisions based on, you know, maybe some limited information, but they're kind of up against it. And so I could see Rise of Fall.
Yeah, and
same
I think
category.
Season one, we actually talked about whether or not we should consider Hopper a dirty cop. You know, he's definitely, you know, he is played heroically in that show, but there are a couple moments where you're like, he's not going by the book. He's kind of a rogue cop here. So maybe we have...
Right. He better be right if he's going to beat
this guy. Yeah, maybe we have Reiser as the rogue scientist. I'm going to roll it. I already have that. We have ourselves an 8. This is Karen Wheeler and the parents. The parents desperately search for their kids after the town hall meeting. It seems that the entire town is riled up against the Hellfire Club. Karen and Ted squabble. Then she calls the police. I think I might be over Karen, Steve.
Really? Is the hair that much of an issue for you?
I don't know what it was. It went away. Love is a fickle thing.
Wow. My goodness. Well, I think, you know, here's what I think might be part of the issue too for you. I think Ted's becoming less funny about some of his issues. So you might see their dynamic a little bit differently.
I did like that Ted said, "Do you see how she twists my words?"
Yes.
I mean, I don't know how much to read into this, but we did just get the biblical reference before this scene, and we see that Jason is sort of twisting that biblical passage to his own ends. Oh. But I still laugh at Ted.
Yeah, Ted isn't like Ted's just not moved by much.
He's very straight laced. He's not an outside the box thinker, basically.
Nah, he voted for Reagan.
He totally voted for Reagan for sure. That leaves us one final storyline, and that is Hopper and Jack and Hagar and company are treated to a feast. As the men chow down, Hopper explains that the guards mean to fatten them up to feed the caged Demogorgon. Then Hopper and Jacken stage a fight so that Hopper can steal a lighter from the guard. Like I said, not hating this. I like that Hopper has a little bit more to do this episode.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, he's been reliant a lot on, you know, Jack and Hagar's plan, and he's had to kind of navigate his way through. Obviously, we had our Die Hard moments, our, you know, Great Escape moments, all that. But this is now, it's like, okay, Hopper has, he has unique information for this particular problem.
Right.
So Hopper is the only guy, really, that you could probably capture that would stand a chance to, you know, to make it through this thing. So now it's an opportunity for Hopper to be, like, he's uniquely qualified. So that's part of it. So that's a good thing, right?
So, yeah, so he gets to play Hopper, the like hero he says, again.
What is he exactly? Yeah, and so now he's a hero, and he's not going to necessarily be a hero just on chutzpah. He's a hero with a strategy. And
well, that's important, you know, to me, because I feel like, even though I am enjoying this, I really do need this plot to give Hopper some kind of special knowledge or some kind of weapon that he can take back to Hawkins.
Well, because you want to believe in Hopper again, too. And if Hopper is just a guy that would make Elle happy when he sees her, then it's like, fine, that's right. I don't need all of this. But if there's something, now we're getting to a point where I feel like we might get something out of this, right? Like, there may be a real, like, instead of it just being like, oh, okay, we saved Hopper from the clutches of the Russians. I'm holding out hope that in this process of, you know, they have a Debbie dog. They've got one of these things. So what else might they have? What else could maybe be acquired? What knowledge? What could come of this Russia adventure that could not have been had he not been? Like, what's the silver lining or the...
Mm-hmm. No, I did, come out it did it? Occur to me at one point to think that maybe there's a way to harness the Demogorgon and sort of unleash the Demogorgon on a bad guy or something like that.
Right.
So,
like, wouldn't that be something? They come in with that, with a he trains the Demogorgon. Like the final scene is him riding a Demogorgon into the Upside Down.
Before the season started, I thought that they were going to play with these gates in a way where it would allow them to travel great distances at one, you know, in a short amount of space. Because I thought, okay, so you go into one gate in Hawkins, and maybe you come at a different gate in Russia. And maybe that would be a way to connect Hopper to L or something like that.
Right. That would be cool. But again, it seems like the gate just takes you to wherever the Upside
Down
is.
Yeah, I don't think that's what they're doing. It's very specific. If you want to get to the Upside Down, you got to go into that lake, because that's the only way to get there. And then you got to, you know, then you're right there in that particular portion of Hawkins.
Right. Yeah, yeah. And it was, yeah, not only, like you said, very explicit, because they're like, okay, I know where I need to go if I want to get out of here. I need to get back to the trailer park. And there's a time issue, right? I mean, that when they're in the Hawkins, they're stuck in a time.
Yeah, that's next episode. Years. I definitely want to talk about that. That's a little bit of mystery, isn't it?
A little bit ahead of time. Yeah, yeah. But so that's the thing, is we're learning a little bit of the rules, right? Like, one thing we talk about in our, you know, Game of Thrones discussions has been, you know, and I need magic with rules.
Yeah, they have to establish the limitations of everyone's capability. And I think this show has usually done a great job at this.
Everything's pretty intentional.
I mean, every now and again, you'll get a scene where Elle just has to try real hard and screw up her face and make it seem like she's, like, squeezing something.
Yeah.
Right? So, and that's, you know, so you see by her exertion that that some sort of invisible magic is happening. And, but they're also pretty good at showing, like, this takes a lot out of her, and then she's... You know, she'll faint, and she's not good for much after that.
Yeah, and that's what's been nice too about, like, where you're with your Scooby Doo gang and with Joyce and Murray, is that these people are all learning to exist, or at least to be able to hold their own in a new way without Elle.
Mm-hmm.
And and that becomes valuable, right? So that it, but, and that's what's, I think it's good for the show, and it's good for us as viewers to be able to sit there and say, okay, look, I mean, you know, otherwise the show becomes, all right, just got to go get L, just got to go get L. And while that's definitely part of it, it's not there. I don't just get the sense that they got to go get L because they know that she can help, but I think they just want to get L because she's, you know, she's a friend.
I'm just going to say one more thing about this. Murray and Joyce are trekking through the Soviet tundra. It made me good to see that they were wearing hats. This was one of my big Game of Thrones gripes. Everyone else was upset about season 8. I just didn't want to see Jon Snow up north without a hat on. You lose a lot of heat through your head. And
that's a great point.
I want to believe my characters are smart. You just put on a hat.
Yeah.
So Murray's supposed to be a smart guy. He's wearing a hat.
He proves it.
He proves it
with headwear.
He proves it with his attire. All right, I'm excited. I'm excited to get to episode 7.
Yeah, me too. And I mean, I don't, are you doing any research or reading any of the fan theories or anything as we're headed into the second volume?
I have done zero, and I'm kind of leaning on you for that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I've been doing a little bit here and there. There's like all these interesting theories, but then I don't want to get, then I, you know, there's a part of me that doesn't want to get too far ahead of it because I kind of just like to let it wash over me.
Yeah. The danger I feel like with fan theories is that it's fun to opine. But then if you get too excited about one particular theory and it doesn't pay off,
right,
then you're kind of a little bit disappointed. And sometimes, and I'm not saying any of our listeners do this, but sometimes fans will think, well, that's stupid. That was really implausible, or, you know, that plot device didn't work because it didn't turn out the way you wanted it to turn out. So I don't know. I mean, I like to have fun every now and again with a fan theory, but I don't. I try not to get married to them.
Yeah, and no, I feel that, and that's the same thing for me too. Is like, because if you start going into one of these theories, like you said, and start going, well, then it has to be this, and then it's not that, and you're like, well, that maybe that would have been better, and now you're out of it, right? You're not you're looking for something in these episodes that might not necessarily have ever needed to be there. But I do think that there's so much intentionality in so many things that they do that it is worth going, wait a minute, you're right, there is a clock in that scene. Because I always noticed, like, for my thing was I always recognized, and it could be that just that's because they're really trying to draw attention to time in general. But in Miss Kenny's office, whether it's her office or it's her home, the clock serves a very noticeable purpose. In terms of drawing attention to it. We see and hear the clock each time Max goes and visits her. She has a clock around her on her necklace.
Interesting.
I don't know if it's just time, like we're just, you know, driving home time imagery, or is there something more to that character that we don't realize?
That's interesting. Yeah, I'll be looking out for that for sure.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if very special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
Since the dawn of time, we've been putting clothes on our back that identify us with our people, our group, our tribe.
And while Bald Move might be one of the smallest, weirdest tribes out there, transcending all concepts of border, class, culture, and creed, we still have respect for the old ways.
At support.baldmove.com, you can get t-shirts, hats, mugs, and more. We have something for every one of our podcasts, or just wear the four pips of the Bald Move logo with pride.
Bald Move merch beats running around naked, and they make a great gift for the Bald Move fan in your life. Join our tribe! Head over to support.baldmove.com and click on merch to start shopping.
Steve, we have some perfect Stranger Things feedback. It turns out that Heather's not the only one that is not liking the Goocher feature in this in this podcast.
Well, I mean, Goochers aren't really ever a good thing, right? I mean, I'd be more upset if you liked a Goocher.
Yeah, yeah. People in general, people should not like Goochers.
And hey, if it were up to me, I would live in a world where there were no Goochers as well. But alas, Eve ate the apple.
Here's what Brian writes. He says, please consider this official feedback that I would prefer Goochers to not exist, as I want to hear your thoughts on all the storylines in each episode. Keep up the great work. Kind regards, Brian. I like the sign-off, kind regards.
Yeah.
That's very good. It's formal, and yet it's not a cliche.
Sure.
Hard to find one of those.
Maybe what we could do is do an episode where we just take all of the things that we never talked about because of the Goochers, and we just put it into one thing. So it'll be a bit of a mishmash of multiple seasons.
That sounds like a lot of work on my part.
That's fine.
You're okay with that?
Yeah, I endorse it.
Okay. So I emailed Brian back and I said, tell me more. How much would you say your discomfort is? 10 being the end of Lost, 1 being the end of Batman Begins. So Brian writes back and says it's an 8.5.
Which,
whoa. Yeah, he equates with watching any scene of The Golden Child wherein Eddie Murphy, who is too jovial, plays against Charles Dance as menacing as ever. Mm. He says, in other words, I would rather avoid having to experience this ever again, but not want to reconsider my entire life choices regarding my chosen forms of entertainment. Mm. So I think 8.5 is pretty high.
Yeah, it's pretty high.
And yet, I do feel like...
And then to invoke the Golden Child, too, I mean...
And then to kind of also insinuate that maybe we coerced him into watching the Golden Child.
Right, yeah, exactly. It's like, I now know what an 8.5 feels like. And that's also your fault.
So if you, too, want to experience that level of discomfort, Cocoons of Horror... You can listen to us give our thoughts on Eddie Murphy's 1986 joint, The Golden Child. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, let's just put it this way. It's not a great movie, But I think it's a great podcast. I think that...
Yes. Yeah, and there are people that I'm sure really love The Golden Child, and for them, they think that to try to denigrate any of it is blasphemy, and they go, oh, it's Eddie Murphy's jovial presence next to the sinister Charles Dance, which makes it an all-time classic.
So it could be one of those things like 50 years from now, people are like, I don't understand why this wasn't like the best picture of the year. This is right. This is clearly the best thing that's ever been put forth. You've got one of the most menacing villains of all time against one of the funniest men of all time. How could you go wrong? And to find out how you could go wrong, Cocoons of Horror, wherever you search for podcasts. So what do you think we should do about the Goocher? I mean, clearly, Brian doesn't like it, and Heather doesn't like it, and I know statistics, and I know that wherever analytics are concerned, when you have a sample of two, that's indicative of future realities, right? So we have 100% of two people surveyed.
Yeah, no, that's fair. Yeah, I mean, I'd be curious. I mean, I don't know that we're going to see anybody that's necessarily pro-Goocher, right? I mean, that would be, like we talked about, it'd be kind of a weird thing for someone to take the side of. But yeah.
Let me just explain the reason for the Goocher is I kind of shoehorned this podcast into a dice rolling affair. And dice, when you roll an eight-sided die and you've only identified seven storylines, you've got to figure out what to do with that empty number. So, I mean, we could like invoke the Brian rule and make something good to happen. What do you think about that?
One thing you could do is for example, if you reach the what was previously the Goocher roll, mm-hmm. How about like instead of like a new storyline, we just play the song "Wicked Game" by Chris Isaak in its entirety.
With video or not? No video.
Well, I mean, we could watch the video, but since it's a podcast, they'd be missing out. But
because whenever I hear that song, I think of the video. I don't know about you.
Well, yeah. Well, yeah. No, I mean, you'd have to.
I think that MTV moment was my entrance into puberty.
That's right. That was your bar mitzvah.
I went there, I went through the Watergate at that moment.
Yeah, well, we all did in one way or another.
All right, so Brian, I guess this is all just to say...
the world was on fire and no one could save me but you.
You know...
Let me dream of you.